You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We light this chalice today as a people dedicated to personal growth. May it burn away the oppressions we've been taught and glow instead with the humility of learning. May it reignite our dreams for a better world and kindle our joy for simple living. May its warmth extend out into forgotten alleyways of exclusion and bring us home to love, to welcoming, and to all the challenges, the questions and the blessings of this beautiful path to becoming a beloved community. Welcome. I welcome you here today on behalf of the Unitarian Fellowship, which has been worshipping in South Australia since 1854 on Kaurna and Piramank lands. I'm Jenny Dyster. I'm currently the lay leader of the church. Our services raise to earth ideas that are in accord with our seven principles, depicted here on the banner at the front. I confess to duplicity in advertising today's address as R&R. Well, it is and it isn't. It's rights and responsibilities, and it's not rest and relaxation or recreation. To be specific, I'm going to address the question of whether we should have a Bill of Rights. Now, we're currently the only Western democracy without one. This may be a bit less laid back than you were expecting or hoping for. Rest, relaxation. But I promise not to thump the podium or harangue you. We are committed by our Unitarian principles to democracy. Mostly these are not framed as rights or responsibilities, but as goals or values. And in fact, each word gets only one mention. Fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. And the fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, etc. My aim is not to persuade you to my point of view. There isn't a Unitarian point of view on whether or not we should have a Bill of Rights. The Unitarian path is any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. You're invited to join us after the service for tea, coffee, and conversation. The
following is a statement from Reverend Dr. Susan Frederick Gray, President of the Unitarian Universalist Association, regarding the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision related to the legality of abortion. This decision manifests the worst fears of those of us who have been working for decades to protect and affirm reproductive rights. The Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision does not alter Unitarian Universalists' commitment to reproductive justice. The overwhelming majority of Unitarian Universalists support keeping abortion legal in all or most cases. This is rooted in our principles and our core religious beliefs that affirm gender equity. It also reflects a moral commitment to the idea that reproductive care is health care and is essential to the well-being of individuals and families. This anti-choice decision by the Supreme Court infringes on our deeply held religious beliefs. Access to abortion and the right to choose is an issue of gender equality, bodily autonomy, and religious liberty, all of which are long-held Unitarian Universalist religious teachings. As I said when the draft decision was leaked in May, I fear this decision will justify efforts to further limit the rights of women, pregnant people, and other vulnerable people and communities. Curtailing reproductive rights will be felt most by people of color, young people, poor and working class people, and those living in rural areas. The rights of people in more vulnerable communities will only become more limited and diminish health care equity. Too many people are already deprived of ready access to comprehensive and equitable reproductive health care, including abortion access. Unitarian Universalists are committed to reproductive justice, a framework created by Black women in the 1980s and 1990s, which affirms the human right to have children, not to have children, to parent the children one has in healthy environments, to safeguard bodily autonomy, and to express one's sexuality freely. The UU faith has a long history of collaborating in this movement and advocating for safe, legal, accessible abortion care. The Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision does not alter Unitarian Universalist's commitment to reproductive justice. Our faith calls us to advocate on behalf of all those who need ready access to safe, legal abortion care whenever and wherever they need it.
Rights and responsibilities. Should Australia have a Bill of Rights? Since the abortion issue has held the world news headlines for a week or three, I thought, why not start there to get our heads around the idea of rights and laws? Firstly, it's important to note that the situation is dramatically different here than in the US, because we don't have a constitutional right to abortion. It's the responsibility of states and territories. Although abortions are partially federally funded under Medicare and the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme, with drugs used regulated nationally through the Therapeutic Goods Administration. I was surprised to hear Western Australia hasn't decriminalised abortion, and that South Australia only decriminalised it last year, March the 2nd, 2021, with the Termination of Pregnancy Act. What? When my friend's daughter became pregnant at 17, 40 years ago, she had no difficulty getting a legal abortion in South Australia. How come? Well, she had a lot in her favour. Her age, 17. Her dad, who was on her side. She had a city address and a first-rate clinic of GPs at South Australia. Some states require two doctors, or even six, to approve, and one must be an obstetrician-gynecologist to agree that it's either necessary or permissible to specify. It's very, very confusing. In New South Wales, doctors are mandated to provide patients with information about counselling services. In the ACT, abortions are legal, and unlike any other state and territory, there's no gestational limit in place. But, of course, abortions must be provided by a medical doctor. Last month, Amnesty International pointed out that there have been many attempts by federal politicians over time to restrict people's access to safe medical termination in Australia. And they cite the example of the RU486 abortion drug, which is still subject to major restrictions due to a deal done by conservative politicians in the 1990s. The UK government is coming under growing pressure from European countries and human rights groups to explain why commitments to abortion and sexual health rights have been removed from an official statement on gender equality. What I'm trying to show is that we're not immune to influences from post-Trump America, influences from the UK, or the depredations of our own extremely socially conservative politicians who are quite convinced they need to be in control of issues beyond their expertise, such as determining gestational limits. Enough on abortion. I just put it up as an example of an area which I thought we had solved. It seems we haven't. So, having started in the middle of this topic, let's go to where I should have begun. Rights are entitlements to perform or not to perform certain actions, to be in certain states. They're entitlements Rights dominate, basically, modern understandings of what actions are permissible and which institutions are just. Rights structure the form of government, the content of laws, the shape of morality as we now see it. To accept a set of rights is to approve a distribution of freedom and authority, and to endorse a certain view of what may, must, or must not be done. There are many categories. Right to life, right to choose, right to vote, to work, to strike, to dissolve parliament, to operate a forklift, equal treatment before the law, to sentence an offender to death, to launch a nuclear first strike, to castle kingside, to pronounce a couple husband and wife, to be left alone, or to use your left hand instead of your right. Now, who's alleged to have rights? Well, we've got children's rights, animal rights, workers' rights, states' rights, and the rights of the people, which is kind of vague, isn't it? And what do rights pertain to? Well, there's a right of free expression, to pass judgment, rights of privacy, the right to remain silent, property rights and bodily rights. Now, freedom of expression does not extend to shouting fire or bomb in a crowded mall. It doesn't extend to hate speech or libel or slander. Moral rights are grounded in moral reasons. Legal rights derive from the laws of society, and customary rights exist by local convention. An asserted right can be affected by the right holder's actions, and that's where responsibilities come in. To be free, we need to obey the law. The lack of an Australian Bill of Rights reflects the views of the framers of the Australian Constitution in the 1890s. The prevailing view was Australia didn't need a Bill of Rights because basic freedoms were adequately protected by common law and the good sense of the elected representatives, as constrained by the doctrine of responsible government. Now, 40, 50 years later, Bob Menzies argued the same way. However, let's see how good the good sense of our elected representatives is and how responsible they are. Australian Aboriginal prisoner cooked to death in van. This article by Tony O'Loughlin, published in June in Sydney, is more than 13 years old. Security guards failed to check on a man who died travelling 250 miles in the back of a van in 47 degree heat. A coroner found he was cooked to death after he spent 4 hours in the van. He was 46, an Aboriginal elder. He suffered third-degree burns after collapsing and falling to the floor of the van while it travelled from Laverton to Kalgoorlie. He was given a pint of water, but he died before he could drink it. His body temperature was so high that when he arrived unconscious in Kalgoorlie Hospital, the medical staff could not cool his body down despite giving him an ice bath. He had a cut on his head from falling and a third-degree burn on his stomach from the hot floor. So that's one disgracefully bad example 13 years ago. Let's go forward 9 years, 4 years ago. The location is on the screen now. Alice Springs Correction Centre. The prisoners were tear-gassed during a riot at the centre sparked by plus 40 temperatures. Officers negotiated and permitted prisoners to stay in the open courtyard of the accommodation block where there is better airflow, Mr. McNairn, the prison spokesman, said. Some prisoners took the opportunity to cause a disturbance and began damaging property. Once attempts to negotiate those prisoners back to the cells failed, chemical spray was used in accordance with standard procedure to subdue them and swiftly bring the situation under control. Well, that's very unfortunate, and you can follow the reasoning of the authorities, but it begs the question of why the conditions were so awful. The climate in the Red Centre hasn't changed for the last 200 years. Should prisoners not be allowed access to air conditioning as a human right, as a territory union leader says? Basically, at the moment, the dorms are built for 8 and 16 prisoners are packed into each. It's a matter we've been arguing with the department for quite a long time because the conditions are inhumane, especially when you've got so many prisoners in one room and the prison's not designed for it. The men's section doesn't have air conditioning and the extraction fans don't work, so there's no circulation. With 50 degree heat being overcrowded, basically there's a huge risk and potential for prisoners to basically kick off. So that's the union view. Similar issues have been raised around the country of unbearable heat in Western Australia's Roebourne prison. And this facility was described not by a union official, but by the state's Office of the Inspector of Custodial Services as posing a significant threat to prisoner health due to extreme temperatures. In January 2022, that's this year, Julie Edwards, the CEO of Jesuit Services, wrote a piece about incarceration in a changing climate. The images are simultaneously striking and terrifying, a raging grass fire that is shooting flames into the sky and destroying nature around it, lapping perilously close to the fences around central New South Wales Lithgow Correctional Centre. As local residents were evacuated and highways were closed to protect public safety, the fire raged out of control just before Christmas 2019. 400 prisoners remain detained. She also wrote, "We need to rethink our justice systems. We require a more humane response that prioritises addressing the underlying causes of offending to drive down the need for prisons in the first place. The goal can be achieved by resourcing prevention, therapeutic and restorative programs, as well as community-led alternatives to prison. We need an end to mandatory sentencing and the prohibition of practices like solitary confinement. Raising the age of criminal responsibility from 10 to 14 would be an immediate way Australian state and territory governments can begin to end the harmful cycle of incarceration." Well, we've been reading this stuff for decades. Absolutely decades. It is hard to imagine that the states are ever going to sort anything out without some overarching rights being established federally. Basically, we need to promote a stronger culture of respect. We need to improve government policy making and administrative decision making. We need to bring Australia into line with other liberal democracies. We need to meet the obligations Australia has undertaken under international law and potentially allow Australian courts to play a broader role in protecting human rights under Australian law. But of course, there's the other side. There are arguments against. One is creating an undue focus on rights as opposed to responsibilities, social justice, or the public interest. It's the idea that that's what a Bill of Rights would do, make people just bang on about rights and pursue them. It might give unelected judges too much power over important social issues. It might undermine our sovereignty by tying us to international standards. But a Bill of Rights isn't a cure for all. It needs to be embedded in a system that's amenable to enacting those rights. After all, at the height of Stalin's purges, the USSR had quite an impressive list of human rights on paper. Let's look at the UK, where Boris Johnson was lately pushing a Bill of Rights. Former Shadow Attorney General for England and Wales, Shami Chakrabarty, described Boris's bill as constitutional butchery intended to scrap the Human Rights Act of 1998. "My ministers," read the Prince of Wales in his mother's place on Tuesday, "will restore the balance of power between the legislature and the courts." But the former Shadow Attorney said, "Scratch the surface and you will find this Bill of Rights to be precisely the opposite. Not a document to empower ordinary people in post-Brexit Britain, but a power grab by the state." The US Bill of Rights is the 10 amendments to the Constitution. And it's the right to bear arms, isn't it, that causes so much an alarm and a suspicion about looking to a Bill of Rights to correct our mistreatment of incarcerated people in motel rooms or prisons, or to safeguard hard-won rights like same-sex marriage, access to fertility support, pregnancy termination. There is an argument against a Bill of Rights that maintains the real benefactors of such laws would be corporations and the wealthy, because they're the ones who can afford to go to court, and they would take advantage of it. So a Bill of Rights would be expensive to develop and implement, and it could lead to an avalanche of litigation. Well, we've got some test cases. Two of our jurisdictions have recently passed charters of rights, the ACT and Victoria, and in neither case has there been a flood of litigation that the government has had to spend money defending. After September 11, 2001, the Australian government introduced 40 new counter-terrorism laws, and aftermath, the attack on the World Trade Center. And these potentially have a negative effect on the right to a fair trial, the right not to be subjected to arbitrary detention, freedom from torture, freedom of expression, movement, privacy, non-discrimination, lots. Do you remember Hanif, Mr. Hanif? He was one of our Indian doctors. He was incarcerated for 260 hours, just a bit more than that, without charge due to these laws. A Bill of Rights could ensure that anti-terrorism laws comply with human rights obligations. Now, all this aside, it cannot be denied that Australia is one of the most democratic countries in the world. However, we have slipped in the rankings over the past 20 years due to our government's sins of omission and commission. Many cases of gross human rights violation have proved that our political system is not the best defendant of human rights in Australia. A systematic and extensive survey of popular opinion conducted in 1993 found that 54% of Australians didn't think that human rights were well protected under the status quo. 72% were in favour of the adoption of a Bill of Rights, and 61% that the final decision in relation to the rights matter should rest with the courts rather than Parliament. It seems that the majority of Australians then believed that a Bill or Charter of Rights would be beneficial. Politicians resisted. They cited border protection and anti-terrorism measures, and our rights and world standing as a democracy declined. And the push lost its impetus because of the events, the boats, the Twin Towers, and acts of terrorism. But we came back to it in 2010. There was a national human rights consultation established to see what rights should be protected and what Australia could do about it. And it recommended a Federal Human Rights Act. The Rudd government wouldn't follow through. In 2017, independent Andrew Wilkie introduced the Australian Bill of Rights into the House of Reps. This contained a codification of entitlements, such as freedom of speech, religion, freedom from torture. It also contained a number of social and economic rights, such as adequate childcare, the right to an adequate standard of living. The bill sought to make Australian legislation invalid to the extent of its inconsistency with the rights provisions contained within it. Did it pass? Nah. So another crash and burn to add to failures in 1944, 1973, 1986, and 1998. The rights we have in our Constitution are two: right to vote and freedom of religion. The first has served us very well, and the second has been more problematic. How do you define religion? A few very big businesses have sneaked into tax-exempt areas by labelling themselves as churches. My understanding is that religions teach us to control ourselves and to help others. And I think if a religion is fixated on controlling others and helping itself, then it's not authentic. But my understanding is not very helpful here, is it? Bearing in mind the many failures to establish more rights, it could be that an incremental approach to protecting rights by statutory means rather than constitutional means, and of protecting certain rights before others, is pragmatic and potentially achievable in Australia. Importantly, it's a process that will allow the oversight of the federal government at every step in continuing to build a culture of rights protection. That would maximise the chances of achieving a working balance between rights and responsibilities, enabling the judiciary to foster the rights of Australians and not vesting misplaced faith in the courts to solve Australia's pressing social, moral and political concerns. There's a gulf between Australians and our government due to the long-standing failure to set out the rights and responsibilities of Australians within the political process. I am hopeful that, step by step, inch by inch, kilometre by kilometre, we can do something about it now that we've swerved to the left federally just a smidge. Go in peace, speak truth, give thanks each day, respect the earth and all creatures, for they are alive like you. Care for your body, it is a wondrous gift. Live simply, be of service. Be guided by your faith and not your fear. Go lightly on your way. Walk in a sacred manner.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.